I'm Larry Magid with CBS News. I don't usually talk about coffee table books on this podcast, but the book The Good Fight, America's Ongoing Struggle for Justice, by Rick Smolin and Jennifer Irwitt, is more than just a coffee table book. Thanks to a smartphone app that works on both iOS and Android, its photographs can come to life with videos, audio, and other media. I had a chance to speak with co-author Rick Smolin, who is an award-winning photographer who's produced many of these beautiful coffee table books, although this one is a bit special thanks to the technology. But it's also special for other reasons, in that it chronicles some very important struggles for equality that have been going on in America for a long time, including women, African Americans, Native Americans, LGBTQ, disabled Americans, and others. But rather than my describing it, let's listen to what co-author Rick Smolin had to say.
With all of the talk about hatred and prejudice and racism that's going on in America right now, I thought it would be interesting to take a look back over the last 100 years of all of the really inspiring struggles that so many groups of Americans, from Native Americans to African Americans to Jewish Americans, Muslim Americans, disabled Americans, LGBT Americans, just all these really amazing stories of how different the world is today for all these groups than it was 100 years ago. You know, I think if you say to someone who represents any one of these groups, would you rather be in 1917 or 2017? The answer right away is definitely today, which by no means means that these problems are all solved, but just that, you know, 100 years ago, women were basically owned by men. I mean, they couldn't open their own credit cards. They'd be fired if they got pregnant. They were not allowed to use contraceptives. I mean, it's quite amazing some of the progress and how recent a lot of this progress is. So again, we just thought it would be interesting to look through the eyes of photographers at all these different struggles to help us all understand what's happening today in America.
You know, I thought a lot about that during the political campaign with the slogan, Make America Great Again. Not that America can't be greater. Of course, we have ways we could improve whatever ideology you believe in. But when I think back to the 50s and 60s, which is a period that I somewhat remember, I certainly remember the 60s, I don't think it was very great for gay people. It wasn't that great for women. It certainly wasn't great for African Americans. And frankly, even as a Caucasian male, it wasn't all that great for me, given what I remember about the pressures and sort of the roles that men were expected to carry out. So in many ways, your book did talk about that and show not so much the contrast for today, but how we got to today.
Yeah, and I think, you know, sometimes when you watch the news, it feels like we're in the middle of this horror show, which I think we are in many ways. And I think, again, just to remind people of what's at stake here, I thought it's interesting to look backwards and also, you know, to own up to some of the darker chapters in America's past and with the hope that we, you know, learn from our mistakes and don't keep repeating them. In addition to some pretty spectacular photographs, we have some of the greatest hits, you know, some of the amazing photographs from the civil rights era. We also have some pictures no one's ever seen before. So we looked at hundreds of thousands of pictures to choose the 180 that actually ended up in the book. And one of the things that I think makes The Good Fight a little bit different than most other books out there is that we found this really interesting technology that lets you point your smartphone at 63 different images. So basically one out of every three images in the book is smartphone enabled. So you point your smartphone at a photograph and you're immediately watching a TED Talk or a YouTube video or a clip from a documentary or a CBS or CNN news show that sort of expands your understanding of the story that the photograph is representing.
I was about to say that since this is a technology podcast, we do need to turn to the technology aspect of the book. And I was fascinated by that. As I went through the book, I got my smartphone out and I downloaded the app. And first of all, I'm impressed at how easy it was. There were no barcodes or whatever those squiggly lines that make everything. QR codes.
QR codes are horrible.
Yeah. Right. You obviously had the ability, or the app you were using had the ability to recognize the actual photograph. And it was easy. It didn't require a lot of time. And up came some very rich media. And I thought it was very interesting knowing you, Rick, and I've known you since you did those original books, what, From Ocean to Alice? Maybe they were or to Alice to Ocean. I'm not sure I'm getting the order right.
Yeah, From Alice to Ocean.
And I don't know if that was your first coffee table book, but you certainly date back to a long time ago in terms of some of your books. And here you are able to take a very old-fashioned thing, right? A paper book, a coffee table book. I had coffee table books when I was a child. They were probably when the coffee table book was invented, but the book was invented hundreds of years ago, and you were able to bring it to life. And I appreciated that because, sure, you could have put this book up on the web. You didn't have to print this book. You could have made this a website. But there was something special about sitting at my coffee table last night. I had the TV on, and I was going back and forth between the TV and the book, and my wife was sitting next to me, and I was showing her some of these pictures, because some of them I was actually there when they were taken, believe it or not, and remember, certainly, if I wasn't there, I remember those fights. Uh-huh. And it was really special having this big coffee table book, but it was even more special to be able to get in there and listen to TED Talks and audio and get the kind of depth that you can only get through digital media.
In some ways, The Good Fight kind of marries together the 600-year-old medium of the book with the internet in a really delightful way. And, you know, I hate QR codes, so we actually found this wonderful technology created by a company called Chalk and Chisel in Washington, D.C. And as you said, it recognizes the photograph as like a fingerprint. So if that same picture was in a 1940 Encyclopedia Britannica and you pointed your phone at it, it would still activate the video, which is so cool.
Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah, people always say, how could you have embedded something in the picture? There's nothing embedded in the picture. It simply sees the picture. It's sort of like when you hold up your phone for Shazam and you're in a restaurant and you're like, what's that song? So this does the same thing to images.
And, well, actually, I'm testing out Google's new Pixel 2, and built into that is Google Lens, which is working in that direction also to be able to take anything it sees and bring in information, recognize it. So I think that this is sort of a glimpse of the future of what we're going to be able to do with our phones, perhaps even with books that were never designed with this technology in mind. Maybe, as you point out, old books come to life.
Yeah, you can retrofit. You can take literally a book from 30 years ago and activate every picture in the book if you want to. In fact, I can change what videos you see after the book is printed. I can say, instead of Larry seeing that TED Talk, I'm going to change it and make it an Aspen Ideas Festival talk. And one of my hopes is that this book is going to reach millennials as well as, older Americans, because I think, my kids are both teenagers. I have a 15-year-old and a 17-year-old. And, when they deign to look up from their phone and actually make eye contact is a rarity these days. Last night, 15 boys came over and they all sat there on their phones, none of them looking at each other. I said, guys, why did you even bother to come over if you're going to be sitting there texting each other? I'm not going to be able to change their behavior, but the moment I showed them the book, suddenly they were all gathered around looking at one boy's iPhone and looking at the videos in the book. So there are a lot of images in The Good Fight that really make you reflect on how recent so much of the progress that we've made in America is. One of the things that stunned me as we were doing the research for the book was that until 1974, there were several states in America that had something called the ugly laws.
I saw that in the book. I was shocked by that. That's not that long ago.
I mean, 74, really?
Yeah.
And basically, the ugly laws were if you were disabled or you had some kind of physical handicap that made other people uncomfortable, you could be fined or arrested for daring to make other people, feel uncomfortable.
Amazing.
And, another story that totally stunned me is a gentleman who was in a flea market one day, and he was looking through some old postcards, and he came across this horrendous picture of a lynching. And he said what was really terrifying about the photograph wasn't just the fact that someone had been lynched, but there were all these people gleefully posing in front of this guy hanging from a tree. And he said to me, I thought that lynchings were done in the dead of night with Ku Klux Klan guys with white hoods on. But this was like a carnival. It was like they would lynch somebody and everybody would pose in front of the pictures. And so he just said he did some research and found out that I think it was Roosevelt fought to make the mailing of postcards illegal. So as of 1918, you could not mail a postcard of lynchings. Mm-hmm. But the lynchings themselves continued until 1948.
And what was interesting about that postcard, which I noticed in the book, is how the people were dressed. These were not necessarily scary-looking people who were celebrating these horrendous crimes. They looked like average, normal Americans. I'm not saying that normal Americans would do this, but I'm saying you couldn't distinguish these, I'm going to say, monsters from normal Americans based on the way they looked, at least.
Yeah, it's sort of the crowd mentality. Another thing that we explored in The Good Fight was the role of the media throughout the last 100 years. And initially, you saw the media reinforcing the stereotypes, you know, degrading people or saying they were less than human. And then with the advent of, you know, Norman Lear and television, and suddenly in your living room, here was somebody of a different religion, a different gender, a different ethnic background, who, you know, also was having their heart broken or was, you know, worried about their children. And suddenly, you know, or even just Archie Bunker, you know, representing the bigot and the homophobic, you know, middle class American guy, that through the use of humor and the topics were discussed that had never been discussed before. And then, of course, now everybody has a broadcast network in their pocket with their phone. And so the role of social media, the Philandro Castile being shot and his girlfriend recording basically him dying in the seat next to him, and then the court cases that came out of it. So, you know, the book is a mixture of optimism and realism. I think it's actually a pretty hopeful book when you realize how much better things are today, but it also acknowledges that we're in a very precarious time right now in America, and it feels like so many of the accomplishments that so many of us thought were kind of etched in stone, we seem to be very close to the cliff right now. And I wanted to make sure that the book reflected, you know, it's not a left-wing book. We have, you know, Bret Stephens, who's a neoconservative writer at the New York Times, who writes the opening foreword to the book, George Takei from Star Trek.
You know, it's interesting. You have a large section about women and the women's movement and the fight that women went through. And it reminded me of a conversation I had with my daughter when she was probably 15 or 16. She's older now, and she no longer believes this. But at times she says, "Dad, I'm not a feminist." And I said, "Well, what part of equal pay for equal work do you not like? Or what part of the ability to go to any college do you not like? What part of the ability to take any job do you not like? What part of being able to have an equal relationship with your partner do you not like?" He goes, "Oh, no, I like all that. I just don't like the way some of these women behave and look." And I'm saying, well, you know, people look and behave different ways, but let's think about what they fought for. And she had no idea. And I talked to her because I was a contemporary of Gloria Steinem and knew these people and tried to get my daughter to understand that there was a big, big fight that led to the freedoms that you now enjoy, whether you consider yourself a feminist or not. As a woman growing up in America, you're enjoying all of these opportunities and freedoms that didn't exist to your grandmother, and for that matter, possibly even your mother in some ways, until these women, whether you like the way they look or not, fought for these rights. And she, of course, now fully understands that. But had your book been available at the time, I probably would have handed it to her or sat there and leaped through it with her.
Yeah, well, I, you know, as the father of a 17-year-old, I also think about the world my daughter is inheriting. And, you know, when you look back 100 years and you find out that, like, you know, In 1917, there were only 22 women who were in the Olympics, and today there's 4,700 women. Oh, and amazing. You know, just speaking to your daughter's comments there, you know, it's this age old thing. Like, if a woman stands up for themselves, they're being shrill or strident, and if a man does it, he's being confident and masculine. You know, even women buy into this idea that a woman actually, you know, standing up for herself and insisting that she be treated fairly and equally somehow is perceived by people as being, you know, that feminism is sort of ruining what it means to be feminine, right?
Right, exactly. And also stereotyping women who are feminists, which, just like any other population, run the gamut racially, yeah, body type. It's potentially anyone, woman, or any man. I think a male can be a feminist as well. I would like to consider myself one. But anyway, you were talking about the writer. So this is a beautifully photographed book, and of course that – it's true with all your books, and you yourself are a great photographer. I didn't take a note whether any of your pictures are in the book.
I've got two pictures in the book. One is of Dennis Banks in front of Mount Rushmore, and he was a very interesting guy. And he was one of the leaders of the American Indian movement. And I was actually fortunate when I was 23 to be sent by Time magazine to the Pine Ridge Indian Reservation, where two FBI agents had been killed. And Dennis was accused of being one of the people that had shot him. And I just completely by luck, I got lost, ended up in the wrong part of the reservation, and I ran into an NPR reporter who said, "Can I trust you?" And I said, "With what?" He said, "I'm the only person who knows where Dennis Banks is. I know him personally, and he's going to do a surprise appearance at Mount Rushmore in half an hour, and you will be the only photographer there because everybody else is sitting at a press conference with the FBI right now." So that was a very, you know, I got lost and ended up getting the only picture of Dennis Banks. He turned out later to be not guilty, but right. He was on the run for a while. And the second picture, speaking to your daughter's comment, is the opening image in the women's section of the image of the woman saying 158 women, shouldn't be scorned at one of the women's marches. I tend to be a glass half full person, which is kind of hard these days with what's been going on in our country. But my hope is that so many of the things that Trump is doing right now are kind of like the sand in the oyster that creates the pearl. You've got grandmothers and millennials marching together to stand up for women's rights. And that is a direct, reaction to the misogyny and the attitude that Trump and other people in the administration have towards women and reproductive rights. And this seems to be, there are so many pictures in this book. When people say, what's your favorite picture in The Good Fight? I kind of freeze because it's like, which of your children do you want to make into the lifeboat? But there's two pictures that really jump to mind when somebody asked me that question. One is there's a really chilling photograph of an elderly woman, a grandmother in a Ku Klux Klan outfit, kissing her 6-month-old granddaughter. Mm. And it's just a chilling photograph because you just feel the hatred being passed on through that kiss. Mm. That children are not born hating anything. When you watch kids of different races playing together at a preschool, they're completely colorblind. Right. All this is imposed on them, and it's something they learn from behavior they watch their parents. So to me, that's the negative picture. The positive picture in the book, and there's lots of positive pictures, but one of the other ones that I really like is there's a Jewish American man with a 7-year-old son on his shoulders, and next to him is a Muslim American man with his 7 or 8-year-old daughter on his shoulders at Chicago Airport protesting Trump's first of 3 bans, all of which were overturned by the courts. And I just love that, I think a lot of us think of Muslims and Jews as somehow being opposed to each other. Mm. And here you've got people coming together to fight what they feel is a terrible injustice. And I think if there's any theme that sort of emerges from The Good Fight, is that sometimes we're at our best when we're the most challenged, that Americans do look after each other and do rally around each other at times like this.
Well, and of course, if you look back at the 60s, when I got my introduction to protest, and both as a journalist and as a student activist, we were also dealing with a war which later turned out to be not only unpopular at the time, but historically considered the wrong policy for America. Not to say that the veterans who fought that war weren't great, brave, courageous people, but so were the anti-war veterans who fought against the war, also brave and courageous, and some of them died as well, not as many, of course. Yeah. But then we had Richard Nixon and Watergate, and we had this whole constellation of events which resulted or had a lot to do with a very tumultuous time in American history. And so when I look around at 2017, it's not exactly analogous, but there are some strong similarities between what was happening then and what's happening now.
Well, even if you look at what happened with Colin Kaepernick and kneeling, the way that this again became a politicized event, as if standing up for something you believe in, risking your career, was somehow not being the best example of patriotism I've seen in years. Right? Somebody who could have just laid back, made his $119 million and basked in the glow, instead decided to risk his career as Muhammad Ali did, right?
Right.
He did the same thing. It was something he believed in, and he stood up for it. So,
Now we look at him historically, and people of both political parties praise what a great man Muhammad Ali was. But at the time, he was vilified by many, by Democrats and Republicans both, who thought that what he did was horrific.
Yeah, I know. So, it's sort of the test of history. I was mentioning to you before that in addition to really spectacular photographs and wonderful captions, there's also 15 separate, very short, intimate, personal essays written by people like George Takei, from Star Trek. I had no idea that he had actually grown up in a concentration camp, an internment camp. And he said that despite the fact that his family was ripped away from their farm, put in an internment camp for several years, he said, he and his family are incredibly patriotic. They totally believe in the American dream. And despite their treatment, they came out feeling just as patriotic as before, which is pretty remarkable. You think you'd be pretty angry if you'd lost your home and your business just simply because of the race that you happen to be from.
Well, Rick, I you did a great job. And this is as I said, it's one of many books of yours that I've had a chance to enjoy, and it's taking a very prominent place on my coffee table. But unlike some of those earlier books, I had to have my phone right next to it.
I wanted to just say two last things, if I might. One is that we're thrilled that Amazon has actually had a special on the book. This ought to be a $100 book. It's a huge cost.
I know. $35 I was surprised at the price. I mean, for a book of that size and quality.
They say it's been selling out, so we're actually going back on press already. And the second thing is that, you know, following Charlottesville, one of the things that really stood out to me is that Apple Computer gave the Anti-Defamation League $1 million, and yep. Then J.P. Morgan Chase did the same thing, and then James Murdoch of the Murdoch family, right? He also gave the Anti-Defamation League $1 million to help them in their fights against hatred and prejudice and injustice. And they're the people that we actually that made this the Good Fight book possible in the first place. So we're thrilled that they're getting all this recognition from other people that feel like they're the organization right now that people want to get behind to stop this madness that's going on in America.
And it's important to point out that the ADL began life as the B'nai B'rith Anti-Defamation League, focusing on anti-Semitism, and now has extended itself to all forms of hate speech, whether it's directed against Muslims, whether it's cyberbullying. It's really broadened its mandate to deal with the way the world has changed and continue, although there's still anti-Semitism as well.
Yeah, no, they're an amazing organization. They fight for so many different groups of people. They were very instrumental in the amendment that made it possible now for people who are gay to get married, mm-hmm. right? Equal rights amendment.
And I actually work with the ADL. I'm on Twitter's Trust and Safety Council, as are they, because what we share in common is a commitment to fight hatred online and bigotry. And in my case, I work around the area of cyberbullying, but they're all related.
Yeah, so they've been wonderful partners, and I'm so excited to hear that Apple had gotten behind them like that. Yeah,
which is unusual. Apple has been slow to catch on to any form of charity. So it's and I noticed you also featured Tim Cook in the book as an example of a business leader who came out as gay, and did so fairly late in the game in terms of his life and having been gay.
Yeah, and to me that's exactly like Colin Kaepernick. It's somebody who didn't need to do it, who mm-hmm. took a risk, used their influence and their visibility to help other people that they were a group they were part of to help everybody. And again, the selflessness of these individuals is what I think is one of the things that makes America great. The more people I think we can point out that do things like this, the better our country will.
And one of the reasons it was a risk for Tim Cook is because Apple sells all over the world, and they sell products in countries where there is still the majority of the population is quite homophobic. So he was taking a risk in terms of alienating probably millions of potential customers. So tell us how people can get their hands. Give me the title again, the price, and where people can get the book.
Sure. So the book's called The Good Fight, America's Ongoing Struggle for Justice. It's available at Amazon, Barnes & Noble, independent bookstores around the country. It's selling out very quickly. We've had people calling wanting to buy 40 copies to send it to all their friends, which has never happened to any book we've ever done before. And the list price is $35, but I see Amazon has got it about $27 right now, which with Prime delivery is actually a fantastic deal.
This is a very substantial coffee table book that, frankly, would make a wonderful holiday present. And that's kind of my thinking about I may take advantage of that price and buy a few of them for my friends.
We're really thrilled with the reaction of the book. And again, with the holidays coming up, with Thanksgiving and you know, Christmas and Hanukkah and Kwanzaa, it's the kind of book you leave out and your family starts looking at it and it starts really informed conversation. It's exactly the opposite of what's happening right now on the internet, right? It's right now it's actually giving you more in-depth and it's giving you different points of view about things that are affecting all of our lives in America at the moment.
Rick Smolin, the creator of The Good Fight, thanks so much and great talking to you.
Thanks, Larry. Take care.